You're listening to CJSF Radio, Simon Fraser, 90.1 FM.
You are listening to CJSF 90.1 FM on your dial, 93.9 Cable FM in Burnaby. And you are listening to Future Talk with your host, Dr. Paul Tenery, professional engineer, professional futurist, and sometimes occasional sessional instructor of future studies at Simon Fraser University. And this is a weekly show that looks at future trends and issues and important items that affect your daily life and will be affecting your life into the future. Welcome to the show. This is a follow-up to last week's special edition of Future Talk, where we were talking about Earth Day, how it began, and some of my musings on the results of many, many years of Earth Day and where we stand today with environmentalism. At the end of the last show, we were looking at Al Gore's view of the world. For Al Gore, the justification for his criticism of civilization is not that we are doing better, but apparently that we're doing better to an increasing extent at the cost of the Earth's ecosystem. And using this argument, he claims this is why we should put a stop to the insane collision with Earth's limits. Al Gore is a member of a long list of what I call cultural pessimists who've experienced the modern world, but who have seen the seeds of its destruction. From Frankenstein to Jurassic Park, humanity's technical ingenuity is seen as a catastrophically exceeding the Earth's limits, creating a world that is spun out of control. Ironically, Al Gore believes that the way to escape this dysfunctionality is by means of the harsh light of truth. And as I pointed out through many of my environmental shows on Future Talk, the light of truth does have, in fact, a harsh edge. Because our food production will continue to give more people more and cheaper food, Al Gore believes that because we're doing this, that we're going to destroy the Earth's forests, pollute our oceans, and so on. However, there's other people, such as, for example, Bjorn Lomborg, who believes that we will not lose our forests, that we will not run out of energy, we're not going to run out of raw materials, and we're not going to run out of water. That, in fact, we have reduced atmospheric pollution in the cities of the developed world, and we have good reason to believe that this will also be achieved in the developing world in time. Our oceans are, in fact, dirtier, but they have not been defiled. They still sustain life. Our rivers have become cleaner than they were, and they support more life than they used to. And although the nutrient influx has increased in many coastal waters, like the Gulf of Mexico, this does not constitute a major problem. In fact, benefits generally outweigh the costs, according to many analysts. Nor is human waste a particularly big problem. The total waste of the United States throughout the 21st century could be deposited in a single square landfill less than 18 miles on a side, or 26% of a place such as Woodward County, Oklahoma. Acid rain, the big problem in the 1960s and 70s, in fact, did not kill off all our forests. Species are not dying out, as many as have claimed, claiming that over half of them would disappear over the next 50 years. In fact, rather than 50%, the figure is likely to be 0.7%. The problem of the ozone layer has more or less been solved by the banning of chlorofluorocarbons. The current outlook on the development of global warming does not, in fact, indicate a catastrophe. Rather, there's good reason to believe that our energy consumption will change towards renewable energy resources way before the end of the century. Indeed, the catastrophe seems rather in spending our resources unwisely on curbing present carbon emissions and the high costs instead of helping developing countries increasing non-fossil fuel research. And finally, our chemical worries and fear of pesticides are misplaced and counterproductive. First, phasing out pesticides will probably waste resources and actually cause more cancer. Second, the main causes of cancer are now known to be not chemicals, but our own lifestyles. The claim of Earth's collapse is mostly based on myths, although many of these myths may be propagated by well-meaning, compassionate people. And one can, of course, choose to believe that these myths may represent only the first of a steady stream of progressively more serious ecological catastrophes. But it is essential to point out that this is purely a matter of conviction. We know of no other substantial problems looming on the horizon. It is difficult not to get the impression that the criticism leveled by politicians such as Al Gore of a dysfunctional civilization is simply an expression of their own Calvinistic sense of guilt. Humans have done so well that some actually feel rather ashamed, and we may really believe that we have deserved global warming as a punishment. But such a conclusion is quite unnecessary. We ought not to punish ourselves in shame. We ought to be pleased that we have thrown off so many of humanity's yokes and made possible fantastic progress in terms of prosperity. And we have to face the facts that on the whole, we have no reason to expect that this progress will not continue. This is what I call the real state of the world. Things are not perfect, but they are not as bad as many of the alarmists claim. And yet, people worry more and more and more. Sure, things are not hunky-dory, and that it's not true that we face no problems at all. Humanity, in fact, still has a broad spectrum of challenges to tackle now and will have many more in the future. The fact is that things are better now, but they're still not good enough. However, being presented with the real state of the world makes us realize that given our past record, it is unlikely that humanity's creativity and collected efforts can handle and find solutions to these problems. Consequently, we can approach the remaining problems with confidence and inspiration to create an even better world. And honestly, we are perfectly aware of the true challenges of our globe. There are still more than 800 million people starving every year. While the number of starving people has decreased and the percentage has decreased rapidly since 1950, this is still far too many. Equally, there are more than 1.2 billion poor people in the world. While the share of poverty has declined rapidly since 1950, this is still far too many. We need to set these challenges as top priorities, and this entails helping the developing countries with structural changes and committing them to the path of democracy and rule of law, while fulfilling our UN pledge of donating 0.7% of the GNP, which currently only Denmark, Norway, and the Netherlands and Sweden fulfill. But it also entails allowing the developed countries into the global economy,
letting them compete precisely in the areas where they have the competitive advantages. This means we need to lift restrictions and cut subsidies on labor-intensive products such as agriculture and textiles, two of the areas most protected by developed countries. As far as the Western world is concerned, we also know the challenges. Many people still die needlessly because of air pollution. While air pollution has decreased dramatically over the past 30 years, it is still too high, especially with regard to microparticulate pollution. Thus, stringent pollution restrictions in areas where benefits outweigh costs will still be a necessary goal. Beyond that, more people need to quit smoking, avoid fatty foods, get more exercise, and as a society, we need to achieve a whole series of social and educational improvements. However, these areas are unfortunately not quite as sexy as focusing on pesticides, oxygen depletion, global warming, forests, wind power, biodiversity. Issues that are more clearly someone else's fault. One of the most serious consequences of the catastrophe Earth theory, promulgated by Gore and others, and the entire environmentally worried elite, is that it undermines our confidence in our ability to solve our remaining problems. It gives us a feeling of being under siege, constantly having to act with our backs to the wall, and this means that we will often implement unwise decisions based on emotional gut reactions. The catastrophe Earth theory gets to modern man and impacts us directly. It frightens us. The social scientist Aaron Wild-Avsky pondered this paradox. How extraordinary. The richest, longest-lived, best-protected, most resourceful civilization, with the highest degree of insight into its own technology, is on its way to becoming the most frightened civilization in history, like a bunch of rabbits. This fear becomes evident when people are interviewed. People are afraid. They fear the future. In the book The Health of the Planet Survey, people were asked how much they believe environmental problems affected their health 10 years ago and now, and how it would affect their children 25 years from now. The respondents were overwhelmingly frightened. The respondents believed that the environmental problems of the future will consistently affect our health much more in the future than it did in the past. That is, at least as far as the industrialized world is concerned, astonishing. We know for a fact that atmospheric pollution, which accounts for more than half of the incidences of environmental-related cancers, have been dramatically reduced around the world. But people still believe that it has become worse and worse. Contributing to this strange state of affairs are politicians like Al Gore, who profit enormously from propagating the catastrophe Earth theory. This is how he was able to afford more than half a dozen cars in his large house estate. Thus, this feeling is in large part caused by the global catastrophe theory. It is due to the steady flow of information about the terrible state of the environment. But how is it possible to believe that things are getting worse when objective figures show exactly the opposite? This apparent paradox seems to be a consequence of prosperity often described by the expression, no food, one problem. Much food, many problems. We are now so well off in so many different respects that we have time to worry about a whole series of other minor problems. Some sociologists see this as an expression of modern society having begun systematically to produce risks which are invisible, for example, pesticides and radioactivity, and about which we have to rely on informed experts since we're unable to make the proper judgments ourselves, since the risks are by definition invisible. However, this argument seems misplaced. In times past, our society produced large numbers of invisible risks. Tuberculosis, the plague, and smallpox could not be seen by the naked eye and seemed to strike at random. These risks were far greater, as is reflected by the much shorter life expectancy of people at that time. It seems more plausible that our society has changed character because it's begun to produce far more information about risks. This is the point made in the introduction. Our fear is due to a high degree to the fact that we are given ever more negative information by scientists, the organizations, the media, and politicians. All of these can profit from feeding us a steady diet of negative information. We are being made aware of things we had no idea we needed to be worried about. More research is being conducted than ever before. One obvious consequence is that we find ever more causal connections. Many of these connections are extremely marginal. And given the statistical nature of most of the studies, some of them will later prove to be wrong. There's nothing improper about that, since this is the way science works. But it does mean that there are ever more bits of accessible information about things we are not necessarily either relevant or even correct. We are familiar with this tendency from the world of medicine and the continuous bombardment of information about do's and don'ts. Now salt is good for you, now it is bad for you. Now estrogens cause breast cancer, now they don't. At the same time, both organizations and the media have an ever-increasing need to profile themselves in the struggle for attention and market segments. The environmental organizations fight for the environment, and therefore they have an obvious interest in presenting a specific image of the world, that the environment is in an awful state and getting poorer. The worse they can portray the environment, the easier it is for them to convince us that they need to spend more money on the environment rather than on hospitals, child daycare, etc. The organizations are keen to tell us that when the deforestation rate in the Amazon has gone up, but not when it has dropped. The media look for interesting and sensational news, but often end up focusing on the negative aspects and giving us yet more worries to consider. When the harvest is good, we hear about how low prices will be bad for the farmers. However, when the harvest is bad, we hear about how consumers will suffer from high prices. When in February 1992, NASA predicted that a hole might open in the ozone layer above the United States, the story hit the front page of Time magazine. NASA's withdrawal of the story 2 months later was only given 4 lines outside the magazine. Unless readers are extremely observant, they would in both situations be left with the distinct impression that the state of the world had deteriorated.
You're listening to CJSF 90.1 FM, 93.9 Cable FM in Burnaby. And you're listening to Future Talk with your host, Dr. Paul Tenery. We're now going to take a short break and listen to a very important public service announcement.
Every year, countless people succumb to the temptation to purchase exotic animals like hedgehogs, lizards, monkeys, even tigers and bears to keep as pets. But life in captivity is often a death sentence for these animals, who may suffer from malnutrition, an improper environment, and the stress of confinement. For more information on this issue, visit the BCSPCA website at www.spca.bc.ca.
Welcome back. You're listening to CJSF 90.1 FM, 93.9 Cable FM in Burnaby. And you are listening to Future Talk with your host, Dr. Paul Tenery, professional futurist.
Welcome back. We're continuing this week with our look at the legacy of Earth Day, which I started back in September 1980. And I'm looking at many decades of environmentalism and where we are today. Continuing from our previous arguments, let's look about the future of setting priorities and evaluating risks. The fears caused by the catastrophe Earth theory are effectively communicated by organizations and the media, which again, and for a variety of reasons, selectively use some of science's many results to confirm concerns. This fear is absolutely decisive because it paralyzes our reasoned judgment. Thus, it is imperative that we regain our ability to prioritize the many different worthy causes. We all care about the environment. Environmental consciousness was ignited around the first American Earth Day in 1970 and the first Canadian Earth Day in 1980, when 17% of Americans mentioned it as one of the most important problems. Since then, however, the environment has never really been the most important problem, which is more likely to be the economy, unemployment, the deficit, rising crime rates, drug abuse, or health care. Even today, the environment seldom rises above 2% in most important problem polls. But there is basic goodwill towards the environment, with 50% of all Americans describing themselves as environmentalists, and probably a slightly higher number of Canadians. Actually, during the Reagan years, the belief that too little was being done for the environment increased, as did the will to set environmental protection over economic growth. In the 1990s, the support may have slipped slightly, but the basic support for tougher environmental policies has remained. In all liberal democracies, voters have displayed ever-increasing and broadening expectations for public services, which has put the squeeze on public funding throughout most of the Western world. Many worthy causes, not just the environmental ones, but also issues of health, education, infrastructure, and care, make ever-increasing demands on our time, attention, and not the least of our money. In the United States, for example, expenditure on the environment increased sevenfold since 1962, significantly outpacing the growth in gross domestic product, which has increased only a little more than threefold. In 1999, expenditures on the environment in the United States exceeded $227 billion, or at 2.4% of GDP. Furthermore, there's no reason to assume that the number of good and deserving environmental products will not grow in the future as well. For this reason, it will be ever more crucial for us to be able to prioritize between the many different causes, each of them worthy. To use an idiom, it is necessary for us to learn to do the dishes until they were clean enough, and not to continue washing them when they were already 99.99999% clean. This problem, of course, is one of prioritization, where 50 to 60% of all American voters declare themselves in agreement with the statement, protecting the environment is so important that requirements and standards cannot be too high, and continuing environmental improvements must be made regardless of costs to the economy or to society. Such an understanding is problematic in at least two ways. First, it prevents prioritizing between environmental problems so that we handle the most important ones. Also, essentially claiming that all environmental problems are of the utmost importance paralyzes thought processes. Then how can you prioritize? Second, it hinders prioritizing between the environment and all other essential areas of society, basically claiming that any environmental problem has absolute first priority over anything else in society. Such statements of dislike of prioritizations have grave consequences. Of course, in real life, popular majorities of 50 to 60% of voters are not translated into approved budgets with 100% of the environment or 0% or other areas. But because so many voters have claimed that we should do everything for the environment, they have essentially left the difficult issue as to which of the many important environmental projects we should choose to be the persons or organizations that set the loudest. In reality, the expressed dislike of prioritization does not mean that we will end up prioritizing, only that our choices will become worse. Against this, I will try to argue that if we went to the best possible solutions for society, we'd have to tackle prioritization head on. Using the title of a recent book, we really do have to do the worst things first. In the following, I will talk about death risks. This does not mean that other essential yardsticks do not exist, such as the risk of illness and the threat to ecosystems. But for one thing, the risk of death is essential and overshadows all other considerations as far as the individual voter is concerned. And for another, it has been the typical focal point of much environmental regulations. First of all, let's ask ourselves how significantly pollution actually is to human life. We can look at graphs showing the proportion of deaths caused by 10 of the most important risk factors. We have to weigh up how this distribution risks tallies with our preconceived idea of where the problems lie. Now we can ask, do these figures reflect our political aims in areas? What we have seen before is that by far the most of the years of life lost, so years of life lost is YLL, in the developing world are caused by hunger, by the lack of access to clean drinking water and sanitation, and by poor hygiene. These problems have practically disappeared in developing countries. Of course, since we eventually have to die, we now face numerous risks as well. Our years of life lost stem primarily from the use of tobacco, alcohol, and non-prescription drugs. A lack of exercise, hypertension, and risks faced at work, for example, accidents and asbestos. We notice that within the OECD, lack of exercise actually leads to loss of more life years than hypertension. Unsafe sex covers both HIV and hepatitis B infections, as well as the group of cervical cancers attributable to infections. Also included in such statistics are the deaths caused by unwanted pregnancies as well as from abortions. Air pollution is indeed a significant health threat in the former socialist countries, where decades of inefficient production, unregulated pollution still takes a big toll. Nevertheless, apart from the risk of unsafe sex and illicit drugs, even here the pollution risk of 3.5%, the WLL, or the years of life lost, is the smallest of the industrialized world risks. And when we look at the OECD area, it becomes obvious that at 6%, the environmental risk from air pollution is by far the smallest of the OECD risks. For this organization, the OECD, air pollution simply accounts for a very small share of overall life years loss. The result corresponds to the finds of Dole and Pito from the chapter on chemicals and pesticides, where we saw that pollution contributed about 2% to cancer. Here we find once again that only a tiny proportion of overall loss of life years is attributable to pollution. The fact that the figure is only 0.6% does not mean that we can just ignore pollution or should dismiss political action, but it does indicate the degree of where we should attach to pollution. We're going to continue looking in this in future programs, so please stay tuned.
You have been listening to Future Talk on CJSF 90.1 FM on your dial, 93.9 cable FM in Burnaby, and Future Talk is a weekly show on important issues that affect you and your future. And this is Dr. Teneri, professional futurist, reminding you that if you're not willing to make the effort to invent your own future, then others will be only too happy to invent it for you. See you next week.
Listening to CJSF Radio Summit.